Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. Today, we're going to talk about Bruegel. It's our 20th anniversary year, and the work that made Bruegel began even before that. We have people today on the podcast who were present at the creation. Their voices are probably well known to you. We have Bruegel's first director, Jean Pisani-Ferry, his co-founder, Nicolas Véran, still with Bruegel, and Caroline de Gruyter, who is affiliated with Bruegel. I believe you're on the board now. You have been a journalist and book author throughout on European affairs, and you were writing about this stuff when Bruegel started, so we're glad to have you as well. Jean, tell us about how Bruegel came to be. When did you get started and why did you do it?
It all started in a lunch I had with Nicolas in mid-October 2002, when we somehow, by accident, we started discussing think tanks. And we both had a strong interest in think tanks. On my side, largely because having studied the Asian financial crisis and having observed that the Europeans were not very strong on ideas, on proposals, they were very much, you know, in a standard diplomatic mode, where the Americans were very forceful, putting forward ideas, plugged in with research, and that gave them an impetus and ability to drive the conversation and the decisions. I had actually co-authored a paper with my colleagues and Benoît Curé. And so I had, from that, I kept an interest in think tanks. And then we started discussing think tanks.
And where were you when this happened? Where were you working and where did you have this fateful lunch?
I think I was still at the Conseil d'Analyse Économique.
I wonder whether you already had resigned. I remember you had an office at the Ministry of Finance already.
Yes, perhaps because we met in Rue de Bourgogne.
In an Italian restaurant that no longer exists.
But it's true. That's probably I was already at it as a treasury.
But in Paris?
In Paris.
We are, of course, speaking to you today from Brussels. So tell us how we got here.
To continue, we had this discussion and we sort of came out with the idea that there was something missing in the ability of the EU to work on international issues. And the idea that came out of this lunch very quickly was the idea of creating a European Center for International Economics. And having had this conversation, we continued working. And very quickly, me being at the Treasury, and with the 40th anniversary of the Élysée Treaty, we thought this is a golden opportunity to push this idea. Because at the time of the celebration of the anniversary of a treaty, you're looking for ideas, you're looking for items to put on in the communique. And so I sort of suggested to colleagues that this could be a good idea to push. And the take-up, the French Treasury at the time was headed by Jean-Pierre Jouyet and by Stéphane Pallez was in charge of international affairs. And so they reacted very positively to the idea. And we spoke of this lunch took place in October. By mid-January, we had the French, Germans, Chirac, Schroeder communique mentioning the project of creating this European Center for International Economics based in Brussels. And the reason for being in Brussels is that essentially we wanted to avoid the curse of having to end up being in Strasbourg, which is not a place where you can have a think tank, neither in terms of supply of ideas nor in terms of policy conversations. So we thought instead of not mentioning Brussels, would be a recipe for endless discussions. So we mentioned Brussels. We mentioned, and the communique mentioned Brussels, mentioned the Franco-German support, mentioned that other member states would be invited to join and that the condition actually for starting would be that a significant number of other member states would be joining, and mentioned the fact that it had to be also privately funded. So the essential of Bruegel's were already present in the communique.
Fascinating. So Strasbourg and also Luxembourg were ruled out from the beginning. Nicolas, you now work in international economics think tanks on both sides of the Atlantic. How do you see Bruegel arriving on that scene? What does that mean to you to do international economics in this context?
Well, as Jean explains, the motivation for creating Bruegel was really, in a way, born from frustrations that Europe, with all its economic heft, even with awareness of all its problems, really didn't have an infrastructure of debating public policy ideas and especially international economic policy ideas commensurate with its size and potential. So it was really, in our mind, filling a gap and creating a platform in which policy ideas could be debated and elaborated in an environment of the best possible quality. So we looked at the U.S. for inspiration primarily for quality criteria, the quality of conversation, the quality of research, and have it in Brussels or and have it in Europe. Our feeling at the time was always when we go to the U.S., we go to universities, we go to think tanks, the conversations are substantial. People exchange ideas. They don't pontificate for too long. Sometimes they do, but often they don't. There is an actual exchange. It's not stiff. It's not frozen. It's not too deferential. There is this vibe in the room that, you know, maybe I can get new ideas by attending that meeting. And we had this frustration that in many European, or for that matter, French environments, that vibe was simply not there because there was too much conformity, too much pomp and ceremony, too much deference, too much inertia. So that was the initial motivation to a large extent. And the U.S. inspiration here is undeniable. It came from the academic world, but also from our experience with think tanks, as Jean said. Inevitably, I have to mention the Institute for International Economics, which at the time was called as such, IIE. A few years later, it became the Peterson Institute for International Economics. I wouldn't say it was a model, because especially the funding is completely different, but it was an inspiration. It was something from which we wanted to draw ideas for best practice.
Bruegel's funding right now is a mix of member state memberships, institutional memberships, pension funds and central banks and things like that, and also private companies, usually large private companies. Listeners can find the full list on our website, bruegel.org. Caroline, when did you become first aware of this, and what did you think of it?
I became aware of it after it was established, after the door had been opened. Because I was living in Switzerland at the time, and one of the first banks that tumbled in the 2007 credit crunch was UBS, the Swiss bank, and they had to be bailed out. I forgot the numbers, but billions. But it happened just like that. And then I remember thinking, ooh, if something like this happens in the rest of Europe, in the EU, we will have a major political problem. So I studied literature. So I didn't exactly, you know, I danced around the subject for a little while in Geneva. But then all my neighbors were bankers or hedge fund managers and so on. So I started talking to them about, you know, what they thought was going on and what their experiences were. And in the end, I ended up covering UBS. And this is when I discovered Bruegel. I came to Brussels also from time to time, and then I moved to Brussels. 2008, I was emptying my boxes, and Lehman Brothers fell. So there we had it. The crisis had reached the EU, and it was a major political crisis. And then I started, because I was living here, I started going to all these lunch briefings that Bruegel was organizing. And I remember, I mean, this was very technical, but because for us journalists, it was really difficult to cover this crisis. The political level was perhaps doable, difficult, but doable. But we had to work also on the technical level, because if you don't know what a rating agency is, or then how are you, or how a bonus structure works, how can you write about it? And so I became a regular to the lunch meetings, and I met a lot of nice people, a lot of people who were extremely helpful, who gave me a lot of information and encouragement as well. But I still remember in the beginning, I felt like, you know, I came from Mars. It was so... At the same time, there were lots of other think tanks in Brussels. So Bruegel didn't... It was not the only think tank. I think in the early 2000s, when we were still, I think, 15 member states, 12 or 15, with no crisis and, you know, everything calm and so on. There were not so many think tanks. The think tanks were in the big member states, in Paris, a few in Germany, in the UK, in London. But when I came back in 2008, there were about 40 think tanks all of a sudden, because there was a lot more Europe. And everybody felt that there was a lot more Europe on the way. And so I think Bruegel started in an environment full of think tanks, and it stood out.
Let me go back to a point that was made by Nicolas about U.S. think tanks and the inspiration for creating Bruegel. I remember going to the U.S. at some point and meeting with people in think tanks. Especially, I remember a meeting at the Center for Global Development, which is a sort of offspring of the Institute for International Economics. And I asked, you know, the people there, what motivates you? Why are you working there instead of being in universities? And the answer was, because we want to change the world. Literally. That's someone told me that. And I was struck, because that indicated the level of ambition. These people were not there to replicate or comment. They wanted to be influential. And actually, as I think, the U.S. think tanks succeeded in being influential. So that was very much the template for creating Bruegel. Now, on the funding side, it turned out to be completely different, and I think rightly so, and on the membership side. But on the ambition, I think the idea of being at the frontier in terms of policy discussion and pushing for good ideas and important ideas, that was very much inspiration. And actually, that's the motto of Bruegel, and it remains so, improving economic policy.
It's good to know that trying to make a difference in the world and trying to make it better is a common goal and also a thing that makes Bruegel stand out, and certainly something I'm proud to be a part of. As we move into the next section of our podcast, Nicolas, I'm going to put you on the spot about a very important matter, which is to say the name. Bruegel, Bruegel, Bruegel. Which are correct and why?
One thing I find difficult to accept is when French people say Bruegel, so my fellow compatriots, please don't say that. But otherwise, we're very very hands-off on the pronunciation. We insist on the spelling. It's Bruegel. We like it when there are no spelling mistakes, but pronunciation is up to the different accents of Europe. And indeed, you did mention the Bruegel way of putting it. Pardon my Belgian, but that takes credit for presumably being the original way of pronouncing. Many people say either Bruegel or Bruegel. The name came from Mario Monti, because after the sequence that Jean mentioned at the very beginning, so we had this French-German declaration, but then we had a long extended sequence of basically building that platform. The communique of Chirac and Schroeder celebrating the treaty between de Gaulle and Adenauer, so 40 years after 63, they said, as Jean mentioned, more member states, not just France and Germany, and private sector. Now, it's easy to say in a sentence, it took us 2 years to build that group of 12 member states, 18 private sector companies that were assembled by end 2004, early 2005, when Bruegel actually got the go-ahead to start actual operations. So we had, if you start in October 2002, we had more than 2 years, almost 2.5 years before we actually started doing something, organizing our first workshop, which was in May 2005, publishing our first paper, which was in September 2005, André Sapir, on European social models. Mario Monti came up with the name because we had, Jean and I, had worked with a wonderful consultant, Soazic Bevon, and many other friends in primarily in Paris, because we still had that bias at the time, and tried to find a name. We had focus groups. We had a number of tools to stimulate creativity. And we came up with basically nothing good. Mario Monti said that, okay, give me a little bit of time to think about it. He came back 2 days later with this idea of Bruegel. In his mind, it was also evocative of the Brussels European and Global Economic Laboratory. But we keep the ambiguity. So Bruegel was registered as just Bruegel. We don't explain. It's not an acronym, and that worked reasonably well for us. So that's one of the many, many, many things that Bruegel owes to Mario Monti.
We definitely rejected the idea of having a four letters acronym.
Or even three letters.
Or even three letters. That nobody, you know, it would have taken ages to escape anonymity.
Bruegel, of course, is a famous family of Flemish painters, and the name was spelled two ways, B-R-U-E-G-E-L, which is how we spell Bruegel the think tank, and Bruegel, B-R-E-U-G-H-E-L, which is the local patois, which, of course, is a nationalized Belgian I have been required to learn. We, as a group, though, do have this singular name and this singular way of approaching things. Jean, can you talk again about the members? I'd like to circle back to that and the mix and how you put that together. How many did you have at the beginning? How did that evolve?
So at the beginning, we had 11 state members, very soon 12. And on this basis, we went out looking for private member, corporate members. The initial idea was that in order to have the state involved, for them to have some ownership in Bruegel, they had to be part of the structure. And at the same time, we had to avoid giving them control. There was a lot of work done, largely by Nicolas together with Rainer Koenig, who was an official from the Bundesbank at the time, or from a Stiftung created by the Bundesbank, to be more precise, in order to define the balances in Bruegel. And what are the rights of the members, and what they actually can't influence? So basically, we ended up saying we need a balance between public and private sector in order to escape the attempt to control by either side. And actually, they were attempts to control or to object to publications by both sides, and we had crisis in the early years with both corporate and state members. I can go back to it. And so the issue was how to define exactly what membership entitles members to do, and what are they paying for. We ended up with the idea that they have to approve the research program. They have a stake in defining the research priorities, but they don't have a right to control any output that Bruegel publishes. And that applies to the states, but that also applies to outside powers. I remember very well President Barroso objecting to publication. It was a policy brief called Last Exit to Lisbon, and Barroso called Mario Monti and said, "What's this paper? How can you write that?" And Monti replied, "As a chairman, I have no control over publications. That's entirely of the responsibility of the director. But as an observer, I actually completely approve the content of this paper." End of conversation. So, you know, that's the defining moment that really made clear to everyone that Bruegel were there to change the conversation, was not shy of putting forward ideas that are controversial, and that it had a structure behind that trust, this stance and this independence.
Was that your paper?
That was a paper I was a co-author of, yeah.
With several others. I don't remember the full lineup, but André was there, and André Sapir and more.
What about the mix of members? Member states versus these institutions that are sort of have a government and maybe a private role as well, and then fully private companies. How did that come together? How do we arrive at the proportions where we are? Is it just happenstance, or is there a strategy? Was that in there from the beginning, Nicolas?
I think Jean said that we wanted this basically neutering of any attempts to take control between different member states. We started with 12, between different corporates, which have diverging interests, but also between member states and corporate sector. And we felt that the member states would bring the emphasis on public policies, the corporate sector would bring the emphasis on the real world, and these influences taken together would make us smarter and more relevant instead of forcing us to make stupid compromises. But that required the right governance formula. And Jean mentioned Rainer Koenig. He's retired now, but he was at the Bundesbank and at the foundation of the Bundesbank, the Stiftung Geld und Währung at the time. And he and we worked hard together. We had a long series of, you know, long meetings where we would fine-tune that model and see how we could build a platform where the public sector and the private sector would have about an equal weight in the governance of the organization and be committed through the governance mechanism to these values of both independence and relevance that Jean just explained. And that wasn't self-evident. Now everybody takes the model of Bruegel as something that, you know, it's obvious. Why would they do it otherwise? But it took a lot of work and of also study of, you know, comparables. It turned out there is no other organization like that. So we essentially invented that model of coexistence between the public and the private sector in a non-profit organization. We had very nice lawyers doing pro bono work with us. That helped a lot. We're very grateful to them. We had the consultant I already mentioned, Swazik Bevan, who also worked pro bono and helped us with questions of strategy, of identity, of how we would communicate that. That was immensely helpful. We had a number of good fairies. And I think this celebration of 20 years is also an opportunity for us to give them credit and say how grateful we feel about all the different contributors who made that balance possible.
To complement what Nicolas just said, the very fact that it's a non-profit association under Belgian law, whose members are states and private companies, is very much an innovation. And I discovered, to my great surprise, that it can be done, and provided it's written somewhere that this is not a treaty. If this is not a treaty, then member states can be members of a private organization.
If they don't pay their dues, we cannot sue them, but, you know, so far it has worked.
I think this mix is also, for me as a consumer of the information that think tanks provide, makes Bruegel stand out. Why? Because I think think tanks in the United States, that you mentioned before, are... there's always some firework there. Yes, there are debates on content, but we all know that they are also often owned by political families. So the American way, things are exaggerated a little bit, made a bit stronger to make a splash. You don't have this in Brussels, because Brussels is based on compromises between so many partners and institutions that, you know, everything is more subdued, if you want. And the think tanks here reflect that very much. And since the other think tanks are mostly institutional, the debates are also a little bit, you know, predictable often. And I think Bruegel escaped that trap. That's for me also why it stood out right from the start. It's specialized. It's very much on content. And you had fresh air with the private sector there. So there was, and I think this also made it more interesting for people from the European institutions to come here, because they, you know, the more important, the more Europe we have, the more rules we also have, lobbying rules. Commission officials are sometimes very, very, you know, for them it's sometimes difficult to meet representatives from the private sector in an informal way. They could meet them here. I've heard this several times. So there was more fresh air here at Bruegel.
Bruegel's transparency is something that we just want to come back to. We can't list all of the different members here. We can't list all the things. But again, listeners, you can find all of the names on the website. And it is a membership model. So for the most part, it's a subscription. Nobody contributes to specific projects. Occasionally, there are a few. They're well labeled, but they're not the bulk of the business. And for me, now as a participant and before as a journalist writing about the Bruegel research, I always found that to be very credible. I've been working with Bruegel certainly since 2011 when I moved to Belgium as a journalist. My first appearances in the Bruegel annual report were as a moderator and an outside participant in the meetings. Now, of course, I'm a contributor and I'm on the inside. I'm hosting this podcast. We've all been working together for a long time. As we move into the next section of the podcast, I'd like to talk about succession and continuity. Jean, you were the first director, you served three terms, and then by design, you had to find a way to keep the institution going. How did you pull that off?
I knew by experience that creating a think tank, let's put it this way, relatively easy, but that what's much more difficult is to create a think tank that does not carry the name and the influence of its founder. So there are plenty of examples of think tanks that discourage any talent to join because people know that they have they won't have an opportunity to get access to the leadership. Having seen think tanks, so many think tanks, being hostage of their first director, and even if they were very successful, this was an obstacle to talents joining because people knew that they had very little of or no hope at all to be accessing the leadership. We thought that it had to be put in the statute that there would be terms limits. So we ended up with 3 years appointments, renewable twice, so maximum 9 years. that was also because Bruegel, being the first director being French, next one had to be most likely from a different nationality. I'm very proud of the fact that having been succeeded by Guntram Wolf, who was my deputy at the time, then when Guntram's terms expired, the choice was to appoint another German man. And because that's the indication in my view that quality prevailed over other considerations. We've reached a point where, what matters is really the quality of the candidate.
Even so, of course, our gender balance still has some scope for improvement. We're thinking long-term about that, maybe too long-term. But I want to completely support what Jean said. It was important for us initially to show that this would not be captured by a single country or, perspective, but also later on to demonstrate, without doing it on purpose, but just because it came up that way, that we were not, dealing with artificial constraints that could diminish quality. I want to go back to one thing you mentioned, Rebecca, which is transparency and the way we deal with those trade-offs with membership, because Caroline put it very well. Having the private sector so important at Bruegel is great because it brings this view from the real world. They can be candid about some things that happen in, the marketplace or whatever the environment in which they do their wheeling and dealing. And that's actually very beneficial for the elaboration of public policy. But we also know that it creates potential for capture, for inappropriate influence, for corruption, if it comes to that. And therefore, we had to find the right balance in managing all these different constraints. And the way we did it is essentially diversification, so having many corporate members from many different sectors, from many different countries, but also transparency. And here, Bruegel has been, I think, very innovative. It has been doing things that now have become commonplace, but were not at the time we did them. So not just saying who are our donors, but how much they give every year to the euro, not just brackets, but specific numbers. Everybody can do their, slicing and dicing of the data. If there is any attachment of that funding to a particular research program, it is disclosed. The outline of the deal is mentioned in the annual report. And also, we ask our fellows to disclose their own conflicts of interest. So, for example, I'm a board member of a private sector company. I've been for several years. This is disclosed every year with an indication of how much of my personal money that represents on the Bruegel website. And you can find all the archive. And that's true for all the core fellows of the teams and for non-resident fellows. We show some flexibility, but we really have these demands, which no other think tank had done until we did it. basically the audience of Bruegel should know where the money comes from, what are the strings attached, if any, and how that may shape the environment. And I think this has helped us enormously because we were never on the defensive in terms of our conflicts of interest. We could always say, look at the annual report, look at the website, make your own judgment. And that has helped us enormously over the years.
I have another remark about why Bruegel, to me as a journalist, feels different from other think tanks. Many other think tanks are, you know, there used to be a very clear, I'm sure you know, there used to be a very clear distinction between journalism and the think tank world. You know, the journalists went to interview think tankers because they had a wealth of information. That distinction is blurred because many think tanks have now, you know, they want to capture people's attention with short blogs, little videos, you know, often made by stagiaires. They become less interesting for journalists. And sometimes they're sitting on the chairs of the journalists. Here, it's so specialized that you never run that risk. I once had, actually, when Guntram was the director, he started having blog posts as well. And I warned him. And I said, don't go there, because all the others are doing it. And, you know, if you want to find valuable information, you have to wade through all these little, not always very clever contributions. Don't do this, because it makes, the fact that you don't do it makes you different. For me, this is high value.
Certainly, as a former journalist, I can confirm that the product that Bruegel puts out is very different in how it is put together, how it is conceived. Even if we sometimes, all of us, write op-eds for publications and sometimes in different formats, perhaps with members of the official sector, as Nicolas has done recently, or representing the government, as Jean, you've gone in and out in your post-director career. But it is very transparent, and it's very different from journalism in terms of the relationship between us, those of us doing the research, and the ideas and content that we produce. Bruegel has always aspired to be a public good. That is a phrase that I've seen over and over again, and that has always really resonated with me. Jean, that was part of the original vision, right? Was to really contribute to the policy?
Absolutely. Again, the motto is improving economic policy. And I think that was the ambition from the start. And I think, you know, by and large, Bruegel delivered on that ambition. I'm very proud of a number of contributions that were made to the discussion. Nicolas being here, I can mention his work on banking union. And that has influenced policy to a degree that did not exist before. I mean, I remember at the time of the banking crisis when we put out a paper outlining what a banking union would consist. There was, I heard from the French Treasury, basically, we took your blueprint and we took your blueprint as a basis for our own reflection. And that's exactly the ambition that we set ourselves by creating Bruegel. And it happened on a number of other issues. It's absolutely major in this regard.
There have been a few identity crisis points. Brexit was one of them. Bruegel is a European think tank, but the UK left Europe. Neither of you were involved in Bruegel leadership at the time, but you were certainly part of the research team. How did Bruegel handle that, and how do you think it went?
Well, the UK had been demanding, but ultimately very constructive partner in the creation of Bruegel. It was one of the 12 member states, or even 11, that Jean mentioned, that were there from the beginning after the initial impulse from France and Germany. And, you know, many UK policymakers, including, you know, big names like Gordon Brown, Peter Mandelson, but also, you know, senior civil servants, Gus O'Donnell, John Cunliffe, and many others, they were very involved in building up Bruegel and making it what it became. And given, you know, natural ways of working and the language and all that, it's also probably the case that they were even more influential than some others who were in the same story. So there was an affinity, there was a kinship that we didn't want to lose because of that stupid Brexit. Sorry, pardon my French. And by and large, that's just what the leadership at the time, Guntram Wolff, Maria de Mertzes, Jean-Claude Trichet as chairman, achieved. So basically, they twisted the statute in a way that allowed the UK to remember as a member of Bruegel, that allowed the Bank of England, which had joined in the meantime, to remain as a member of Bruegel. And we still work with them. It's become a bit complicated, of course, when we formulate policy options for the EU to do it, you know, the EU and the UK, the EU without the UK. In financial services, sometimes it's even the EU in competition with the UK, which is normal. So we certainly produce less policy recommendation content now specifically for the UK than we do for the EU, but they're very much part of the conversation and we like it like that.
Would there be room for more non-EU countries to join?
Well, certainly candidate countries, but that's a matter for the board, and they're the ones who can answer that question.
How would you approach that, Caroline? Canada, no. Switzerland, yes. What do you think?
I think, you know, what you see in Europe anyway at the moment is everybody's moving, you know, despite posturing and all that, everybody's moving closer to the center, which includes... I mean, the Nordics were in there, except Finland, but the Nordics were in there just for the market, like the British were. And they didn't want to have all this political stuff. Huh? That has changed because of external threats. But so everybody's moving more to the center, but that includes Switzerland, which has broken off negotiations about a new framework agreement with the EU, spent sulking like three, four years, thinking maybe they could gang up with the UK, didn't work. And now, you know, they came back to the negotiating table. The same is happening with the UK. The Norwegians are also getting closer, for instance. They're participating in defense projects. And I've lived both in Norway and in Switzerland, never in the UK. And there you discover quickly that most of the decisions that are taken in Brussels are eventually, sometimes directly, sometimes with a little delay, taken over by the Swiss and the Norwegians. They're part of this. Huh? And that you see reflected, I think, in Bruegel. The Swiss and the Norwegians should be members too, in my view, because they're active on the most parts of the single market. They have banks. There's daily interaction on every field that Bruegel covers, and it matters hugely for them.
Now, what about the rest of the world? Bruegel has had researchers in India, in China, in Taiwan. How did you incorporate that into the research program?
There's nothing that prevents Bruegel from working on those issues. Actually, this was initially... Remember that when Bruegel was created, we thought, wrongly, that the job had been done internally to integrate within the EU and that the outward orientation was fundamental. So we got distracted for quite some time by internal problems. But this idea of reaching out to other continents had been there. We created, for example, an Asia-Europe Economic Forum, was when I was in the position of director, was quite successful because we had Chinese, Japanese, and Korean members, and we met annually. That's really part of the identity. And I think in today's world, it has to become even more part of the agenda, because we're in a different world. We have to understand that world. The EU has to play its role in full in that world. Interestingly, the rest of the world still considers that the EU is on par largely with the US and China in terms of global influence, we have to live up to this this expectation. And I think that's a very strong agenda for Bruegel. So it's not not at all, you know, something that distracts from domestic concerns, internal EU concerns. It's something of primary importance.
We're coming to the end of our podcast now. But of course, listeners, you've got the entire archive. Another great thing about Bruegel is the archive remains free and accessible on the website, bruegel.org. I'd like to hear from each of you if there's a particular aspiration or hope you have for Bruegel going forward, and also if there's a particular anecdote or something you'd like to share. I know for me, I've been really impressed with the range of research products, from short opinion pieces that can go in any publication in the world to the books that all of you have produced. Kathleen, yours have not been for Bruegel, but still, we have just this breadth of presentation of ideas always in an accessible and readable way. And Nicola's recent book, published through Bruegel, is an example of that. So I'd like to see more of that going forward. Jean.
Let me first mention the fact that, you know, Bruegel was up and running when the crisis hit, when the global financial crisis hit. Up and running meaning, you know, having established a reputation, having put forward a few papers. But what defined Bruegel in the early years was really the whole discussion about the global financial crisis, the response to it, the euro crisis, etc. So a very macro financial dimension. And what I think was very difficult for the successors was to find new items that would all equally define Bruegel. And I think it did happen with Guntram, under Guntram's leadership, now under Jeroen's leadership, the ability to, you know, be flexible, to address issues that are of utmost importance but were not part of the initial agenda. And I think that's also what makes the identity of Bruegel. In terms of anecdotes, I just want to mention that, you know, we had our crisis. We had our crisis with corporate members. We had our crisis with state members. Everybody has forgotten, but the Bundestag voted Germany out of Bruegel.
But they reversed it.
They did it in a very German way. They gave prior notice. We had 1 year to lobby the Bundestag. At the time, I, in a very French way, I went to the Chancellery and I said, "What that?" And the answer was, "That's Parliament. Make your case with who matters in Parliament." The rationale for voting Germany out of Bruegel was that we happened to have two board members who were both formally affiliated with SPD. And so seen from the CDU, that was an indication that there was something fishy with Bruegel's constitution and with its functioning. In fact, one of them was had moved to the private sector. One of them had moved to the International Bank for EBRD. But we had this crisis, and we had in the same way a crisis with the corporate sectors, with, you know, thing that were written and that displeased some corporate members. And they let us know and they left. And we said, "Okay, you can leave. That's a pity. I mean, you're doing yourself some harm." But for Bruegel, no corporate member represents more than, I think, 2-3% at the time. Yeah. So we could afford to displease corporate members. And I think that was a demonstration of independence.
A recommendation. The Economist once wrote about the think tankery circuit in Brussels coming alive in the mid-2000s as good coffee and croissant, dull speeches, and a brief exchange of conventional wisdom. Thinking ahead, thinking about the future, I hope that Bruegel will stay out of that description, as it has.
You're going to vote up for a better coffee machine, right?
Yeah. No, keep the croissants and the coffee. But for the rest, no dull speeches and no conventional wisdom, please.
I concur with that recommendation. I think for the reasons you explained, Caroline, when you're in Brussels, it becomes very easy to become completely boring because that's what the environment, to a certain extent, creates incentives for that even. So I wouldn't go as far as saying that's what they demand of you. And so we have to resist that. We have to keep the sense of freshness, of openness, of willingness not to provoke for the sake of provocation, but to provoke for the sake of advancing new ideas and stimulate new thinking, which was very much, as we discussed today, present at the creation of Bruegel. Jean mentioned this little misunderstanding with the Bundestag about party affiliation. It's also important for us to keep our identity as, you know, inevitably we look at the European economy from a European perspective. So that makes us a little bit pro-European by design, but we should be careful with that. We should be as attuned to the flaws of European integration and its shortcomings as the citizenry, frankly, is, and they are. We should also be very careful to keep the party political neutrality that I think Bruegel has established from the start. Let me just finish by paying tribute to some of the political godfathers and godmothers. It was a different era. There were unfortunately more godfathers and godmothers. It's improving now, but still not where it should be. But people like Caio Corvese at the German Ministry of Finance and his bosses, Hans Eichel and Pierre Steinbrück, people like Francis Maire in France, the finance minister, and Jean-Pierre Jouyet, who Jean mentioned under him as head of the Treasury, and also the people who were advising President Chirac and later President Sarkozy at the Élysée Palace and later other presidents, you know. And I could go on with other member states. I won't do it for the sake of brevity. But I think those politicians achieved something that is not self-evident. They accepted that Bruegel would be created with their sponsorship and without their control. And for politicians, that's very difficult. So I think it's appropriate to pay them this tribute now that we remember the circumstances of our creation.
20 years in, hopefully many more. This has been The Sound of Economics, hopefully always relevant and rarely boring. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, and I am here today with Bruegel's founders, Jean Pisani-Ferry and Nicolas Véran, who are still doing research for Bruegel, and Bruegel board member Caroline de Kreiter. We thank you for tuning in. We hope you'll check out all the great stuff on our website, Bruegel.org, and Bruegel.org redirects, so you can go either way if you're feeling Flemish. Thanks very much, and see you next time.